Get exclusive content you just can't wait to hear. Hit us with your feedback. We want to know how you feel. So download the Shiny Radio. Get it free from the App Store. Download the Shiny Radio. See our features and much more. Download the Shiny Radio app for free now.
Broadcasting from Shiny Radio, iHeart, live from New York City. This is the Linda Monroe Show, and I am Linda Monroe. If you want to know more about me and what I do, go to lindamonroe.com. Don't forget to go to Google Play and download the Shiny Radio app. We're live from New York City talking about in and everything. This show is sponsored by Rashad's Reliable Cars, Terry Ingram, Sr., CEO and owner. Too blessed to be stressed. I want to take this opportunity to thank all my listeners for listening to my broadcast each and every week. We're dropping these nuggets to help you live your best life. Listen, my listeners, I have the most awesome guest today for you. I am so excited he came across my life. His name is Captain William Smith. How are you, Captain, today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm blessed and highly favored. I do want to thank you for taking the opportunity out of your busy schedule to do this interview with me today. So listen.
Well, I'm honored. Thank you.
You're welcome. I have one question for you.
Yes,
what
ma'am.
Has been the lowest point of your life, and how has it propelled you to where you are today?
The lowest point of my life was my incarceration. And at the time, I didn't understand why I was going through this. I was ultimately vindicated. Charges were overturned, and I was set free. But God does move in mysterious ways, and I use my experience to share with other people that are reentering to help them find a better path. I don't think anybody can experience anything any worse besides death of a family member, which I experienced three deaths of three family members while I was in prison at the same time, not being able to go to their funerals. I don't think it can get any lower than that. But from that, I was able to pull myself back up, take my experiences, and now I help and teach other people that are transitioning, whether it's from an addiction to drugs or alcohol or from a prison or jail term. I needed to experience what I experienced to be able to write the books I wrote today and help the people I'm helping today. In a nutshell.
Okay. And tell us a little bit more about what you do today and how you got to where you are today.
All right. Well, back in 2004 is when I fell. I served 26 months. While in prison, I lived, ate, and that was my life. You know, I slept, I worked, and I noticed a lot of things while I was going through the appeal process. I had very strong advocates outside of the prison working with me. I will tell you the corruption in the judicial system and the Department of Corrections goes deep. There are a majority of people in there that have been over-sentenced. There are people in there that shouldn't be in prison. But don't get me wrong, there's some people that are in there that need to be in there and do not need to be walking around on the streets. But the ones that made mistakes or just got caught up in the wrong crowd because they became a product of their own environment, they deserve second chances. I noticed what was going on while I was fighting the state and the Department of Corrections. 26 months passed. I was released. I was vindicated. All the charges were overturned, and I was free again. But prison takes something from your soul. And at the time, I lost my religion. I didn't believe. I didn't understand why I was going through what I was going through. I was very angry. But I learned afterwards that anger was nothing more than poison. And if I held on to that anger, I would eventually destroy and poison myself along with my soul. I was released in 2006. I was able to come back and join society, but I had nothing when I was released. Every dime was spent. The only satisfaction I had was the judge at the time that proceeded on my trial, my case, was removed from her position. She was never allowed to practice law, never allowed to run for an elected position again in the state of North Carolina. That was the only solace, I guess, I had leaving, that I did accomplish something. I later on found out that several other people that were before her that didn't get a fair trial were allowed to have a second chance as well. Coming out of something, and in 26 months is not long. That's, some guys can do that on their head. There's people in there that I still know that are still in prison when I was in there that I'm trying to help and advocate for. And they've been in there for 20, 25, some 30 years. And I can't even imagine being locked up like a rat for that long. But I had to take care and focus on me. And by doing that, I realized coming out of a situation of that incarceration, there was no help. The Department of Corrections does not have any type of program at the time to help people return or give them incentive to become a better citizen. The Department of Corrections and the states, the prosecutors, set it up so they will return. And we call this recidivism. And now I'm a part of helping reduce, if not end, recidivism rates by helping people move forward and helping help them realize their potential that they have. The potential that they have is things that they do while they're incarcerated. And there's generally trades that are associated with that. I know that I knew a lot of people that are in certain trades, and they took that to another level when they were released or returned to home. So I thought about this and said, okay, there needs to be some type of program that returning citizens can have, a stepping stone that sets them up for success and not for failure. By doing so, this took me 10 years. This didn't happen overnight. I was homeless. I lived on a friend's couch. I had no car. I started a job digging ditches in a construction company, and I worked my way up from that. If I couldn't find a job, I made a job. I didn't go out to bars. I didn't date anyone. It was totally selfish plan that I had. Getting out was about me, because it had to be, because I had to succeed, because at the end of the day, the only person that was left standing was me. And by doing so, I was able to put together a step program on one of the books that I wrote called Ditches to Riches. And this was literally me starting out digging ditches and getting to the point in my life now that I fly large private corporate aircraft for some very well-known people in the Tampa Bay area. One of these people was the founder of Outback Steakhouse. He now owns PDQ and Glory Days, which is a sports bar. I work with Tony Dungy. Coach Dungy is an awesome mentor. I had the opportunity to fly him around as a pilot. And by doing what I was doing and giving back to my community and helping, I created a value in myself. What a lot of people that haven't been in prison don't really understand is when you come out of a situation like that, you feel an inch tall. You're paranoid. You don't trust anybody. You don't believe in anybody. You don't believe in yourself. And you feel like the world's against you, because every time you go to fill out an application, they deny it. They slam the door in your face. It's like they don't, no one wants to give you a chance, because they look at you and say, oh, well, you were in prison, then we can't use you here. And that is a horrible feeling. When you're getting out and you're alone, you feel like you have no one, and then you have to deal with the world on the world's terms. It's not fun. But it's not the end of the world. And that's why I started a book. I started, I wrote a book. I started a STEP program. I now go to facilities. It's usually greens or minimum custody. People are getting ready to get out within the next 6 months. And I speak to these individuals, these returning citizens. I go to AA meetings and NA meetings where people are at the brink of probably going to prison or to jail. And I work with these people on how to become or find themselves and become something better than they were. I've had great success in it. I work with a 501c3 down in Southwest Florida called Cons Helping Cons. What we do now for our community is we help people that are returning or help people that are overcoming some type of an addiction problem or struggling, get a job. They have income. They have a community around them. They have a support system. They have health care. They have a place to live. They have an opportunity to succeed and not fail. And I look back now at the time, at the beginning of this conversation, talk about how I lost my religion. I have it back now because now I see the big picture that God had. The big picture was, I'm not going to tell you, you know, how important you are to what my plan is. You have to figure it out on your own, because once I figured it out on my own, I had that enlightening moment. This is what you wanted me to do. This is why you put me in the place that you put me in. Doesn't matter innocent or guilt. It was, I had to experience that too. And he knew that I was going to rationalize and see that there was a problem, and I'm a problem solver. And I looked at this in the micro and then looked at it again in the macro. And I saw that the reason that I was put through the hell that I was put through with losing my kids, my wife, my career, my family, my house, everything, is because, number one, he was teaching me a lesson. Number two, he knew I was going to make it through this and I was going to be able to help people 10 to 15 years later that were going through the same thing. So when it's your darkest hour and you feel God's not there, he is. But he has so much more for you in your future. So what he doesn't want you to do is give up on yourself, because I know that he didn't give up on me. He was grooming me and teaching me. Because when I tell my story that I went from prison to flying around in multi-million dollar jets with some of the most renowned people in the NFL and then just in the industry itself, they're like, how do you do that? And if it wasn't for me going through what I went through and the plan that God had for me at the time, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you or so many others. I wouldn't be able to share what I went through, my experience with others to help them become successful. And through the programs that I work with and the books that I've written, we've created a great mentoring program to where you start off when you're coming out, you have the 90-day program, and then you get, you know, you get the income, you have a place to live, and then you start mentoring. And I say you, the returning citizen, starts mentoring others that are coming out. So it works and it keeps on working. And people graduate from this. They become successful. They have their own business and they help other people the way I've been helping other people. And it's just amazing how things work, but it's never in our time. But after the past, 2006, 16 years now, 16 years later, I'm here still sharing this conversation and having this conversation and helping people get through their lowest time.
Now, this 12-step program that you have, I mean, can people from other states come in to your program?
Or? Yeah, exactly. And what I want to do, I had to start in my own backyard and build this. So I started in the Pasco Hillsborough County area. And I met with a lot of good people in that network. And it grew and it expanded. And then there's a couple, you know, I start getting emails from people where the family members hear about me on social media or online or what I'm doing. And they'll They'll go to my website at CaptainWillSmith.com. They'll reach out to me via email. I'll send it, of course, media mail to their loved one that's getting ready to be released. I would like to get it into even more states, because the more we help people and the more we educate the people that have never been through an incarceration, it's the families know how bad it is. And everybody has a loved one that's been incarcerated or, you know, gone through bad times, whether it's from drugs or addiction or, you know, just being a product of their own environment and you know, hanging out with the wrong people. They understand how bad the system can be, and the system is not built to for you to be successful, because you are business to them. And if you don't return, business is not good. So they need that to make money. The states get state funding. They also get federal funding. There's a lot of funding that goes to the prison system. And there's more and more people looking at it as a business opportunity, where they're privately opening up prisons or taking over government-ran prisons, and they do it themselves because they're getting the funding now. So I see this happening. I'm like, this shouldn't be a prison system. We shouldn't house our mentally insane people or people that are struggling with mental health issues and then just freeing them. We need to make this to where, you know, we can help everyone, and the people that have mental health issues get that attention they need, and the people that just had were dealt a bad hand in life and just need a second chance, they have that opportunity too. So there's a lot involved with what I'm doing, and I want to grow this, but every seed has to start somewhere. So mine happened to be in Florida, because that's where I started all this from. And it's getting recognition. More and more people are getting involved. But I need the platform. The big platform right now is the workbook that I have that I sent to you, and the actual book itself, and working the program and doing it from a platform where people know there's help out there. Down here in Florida, I work with companies, contractors that hire whoever makes it through the program successfully. And we have last time we looked, 96.7% pass rate. That means that out of 100 people, I don't know where the 0.7 they get that from. It's just a ratio number, I guess, that have come through. Out of 100 people that come through, 96 of them are successful. They have their own business, their family, their lives back, a place to live, a car. And they either open up their own business or they become, a manager of a business that they're working for. So they're not always stuck and making, you know, minimum wage. They work their way up and become successful out of it. And that's been going on for about 2 years now, working with Consulting Cons, working with into the recidivism rate, and working with the 501c3s that I work with. I also work with the county sheriff's department. I work with the state of Tallahassee. They have my book. I don't have my workbook yet, but my book on their JPay account for people that are being released. So that was a long process getting all that approved. That took me about a year just to get my book approved through Tallahassee. But I would like to be able to have it on every level in every state. I just need to do more networking and, you know, work with people so they know that, hey, there's a program out there designed by an inmate for people that are returning, you know, for returning citizens. The biggest outcome that I've had, or positive, I guess it would be a positive reinforcement that I've had from the returning citizens, is they say, you know what, Will, there are so many people that have never been in prison that want to tell us how to succeed. Right. And you're the only person that I know that's been where we are right now and giving us advice on how to succeed. And they listen, they tell me, I will listen to you before I listen to anybody else, because they haven't been where I've been. They haven't walked a mile in my shoes. They have no idea how I feel. They have no idea what I've seen. They have no idea what has happened to me in here. They don't understand because they never lived it the way you lived it. And that's what gains the attention when I go into these facilities and why I have them every, because I have them every 6 months, why they say, please, Will, come in, you make a difference. You know, and I give the books out. I know these guys don't have a lot of money, and I just give them out for free. So they have something tangible to lead with and something to study while they're in there. But the more we can help, the better. And I'm just with podcasts like this and social media, we just need to get the word out and let people know, you know, I've worked really, really hard with this. I know it's going to go to the next level. We just need to get awareness and let more people know that this program exists. It was written, designed by someone that was incarcerated. And that's what set my transition program aside from the other ones you might hear about that a state psychiatrist came up with, or someone with a PhD in mental health who sat down and wrote. They don't know anything about what someone goes through when they're in prison. The only person that knows is someone that's been there.
Exactly. I don't know if you, well, I didn't really look at the Daryl Brooks trial, but I did look at his sentencing. His sentencing on YouTube. And you know, Captain Will, my heart just broke. Because yep. I'm saying, you can see the child in this man. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
He sat there and cried. And to be in a court system where you have no support, I just can't visualize that, you know, because I grew up in a very close family. And if I ever got in trouble, I would hope somebody in my family would be there. Now, I did see an interview with his mom. She said, you know, she's not going to be at his sentencing hearing, but she does realize he has some mental health issues. And as being a former person incarcerated, you know, that's not going to get addressed in that prison system.
It does not. What they do is medicate you. They'll literally put you on some of your, and I saw many walking around drooling on themselves. That's how heavily medicated they were.
Wow.
Because they don't have the facilities, the abilities, the capabilities, the doctors to address the mental side of why people are in there. I have two nephews. One has just gotten out of prison up in North Carolina. The other one is in Georgia on a 10-year stint. And one of them, he was perfectly fine when he was growing up as a child. He's now been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. And he wasn't like that, but he had a bad family upbringing. My sister and her husband, they were never there. And I really feel bad for these guys, women and men alike, that never had a normal childhood. And when I say product of their environment, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. They were brought up around abuse, whether it's physical or sexual. They had major trauma and loss in their life emotionally. And that's what breaks them inside in their mind. And that's what I really believe, that's where some of this, the health issues, mental health issues stem from. Some of them are, yes, chemical, but a lot of them has to do with abuse of alcohol, drugs, at a young age, because their brains stop maturing when they start inducing things like alcohol, marijuana, and drugs. And you'll see a grown man break down like a child, because in their mind, they're still that little child seeking attention and love from a parent that was never there or barely there. I get it. I've seen it. I've lived with it. I helped 40-year-old men learn how to read and write so they could write a letter or read the Bible while I was incarcerated. I heard their stories. They spoke to me more than they spoke to the state psychiatrist, because I guess they trusted me more than they trusted the state psychiatrist. And it came to a point to where the state psychiatrist pulled me aside and says, well, can you tell us what? I was like, no, they trusted me enough to tell me, you know, their deepest, darkest secrets. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to share it with you, because right. you're not going to take that information and do something positive with it.
Exactly.
And that didn't go over very well with them, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to help them with something they knew nothing about. But I know I helped some people that are in there. And to this day, you and I know a gentleman that I've, you know, still been there to advocate for, after I was released in 2006. And here it is, 2022, we're rolling into 2023, and I still talk to him. I still send him money. I still accept his phone calls. That's how invested I am in this. And hopefully one day we'll see his freedom. But that's what it takes. It takes a lot of understanding, and I would love to be able to get in front of, you know, into some of these prisons or just talk to some of these rule makers and lawmakers and say, hey, do you realize what you're dealing with? This is not, you know, side potatoes that you didn't finish on your plate that you just throw into the floor and forget about. These are human beings we're talking about. These are people that weren't given or allowed the same opportunities as maybe you were. And you need to take a different stance, you know, on how you address this. And we need to start with the mental health issue. You know, we did have mental health hospitals. Dorothea Dix is right there in Raleigh.
Right.
Started years and years ago, but we got away from that. And we need to take some of these prisons that they've closed up, and the structures there, the infrastructures there, and turn them into a place where we can help the people that are struggling with the mental health aspect of why they are where they are. If we don't start doing that, all our streets are going to look like the streets of San Francisco or New York, or, you know, we have to start helping and saying, hey, number one, recognize the problem. Number two, create a solution. And number three, implement that solution. And with my book, Ditches to Riches, I'm not on the mental side of it because I don't have that degree or understanding besides living with them. But the whole recovery part and transitioning part, I have enough knowledge to be able to help with that. And I built the basis of the book to at least help that part of the program succeed when people are transitioning and they realize, hey, there's a program out there. I can, you know, have my life back. I can have a car. I can have a good job. And I can, you know, be a part of my community again. And that's what excites them. And it's written by someone that's been where I've been. So we just need to get the, you know, just get the information out there and start helping and start working. The biggest struggle I see in everywhere is housing. I think that's going to lessen up a little bit, but I'm working down here in Florida with a couple of companies to where we're going to do some mini homes to where everyone has a place to come. They can call it their own. They'll own it. And then they can take that and sell it to another returning citizen. And they go through the same. We've got a great program that works really, really well. Because eventually a person moves out of their mini home, get an apartment, they save up, you know, and then 5 or 6 years down the road, they have their own house, you know, and they reestablish themselves in the community and they're voting again. And, you know, they've got their driver's license back and they're going on vacations and, you know, they're working 9 to 5 and they start a little retirement pension with a small IRA at first and build that up. So I've got that backbone and that structure in there and that's working well. It's just the other side is the mental health side. And that's something else I'm, you know, working with people on. But we have to have a place. And prison is not the place to put people with mental health issues. I've lived it and I've seen it. And they really, it's kind of sad. It's kind of like they just medicate them, wait for them to die, which is horrible. But that's what I saw. That's what I experienced. And some of them so depressed, they just took their own lives. And I've seen that too.
Yeah, well, I've been going in prisons, doing prison ministry for over 46 years now. And, you know, this is just God because, you know, I've never heard of you. And you've never heard of me. But, you know, God connects because we have the same mindset here. My vision is to build communities. My daughter is so hooked on these little tiny homes. You know, I'm like, girl, you better get your mindset up, okay? So that's my vision, and wanted to ask you, and I'm going to ask you on the air, because I have a senator up in North Carolina that I've been talking to. He's from the next county from my hometown. And, you know, I was explaining to him the issues that's going on in the North Carolina state prison system. So he wants me to come and address the legislation. So will you go with me?
I would love to. I would love to have the opportunity and be blessed to be able to do that and talk to these people and try to talk some sense to them.
Yeah, you know, what you say it's a money-making business there for them. And because if they really knew, Captain Will, what goes on inside those prisons, they will shut those doors down. And that is my agenda. Like you said, there are some that need to stay in there, but they may have those mental health issues that had not been addressed. I don't think prison, well, you know, I listen to people coming out of prison and they say that's the best thing that happened to them. And one of my friends told me, he said, Linda, prison is the place where God mold men. And, you know, I look at the people coming out that I'm personally involved with, and I tell you, they come out running, Captain Will.
Yep.
They come out running, and they're being such a blessing right now that I'm just so excited. They feel like my kids, you know?
Well, they do, because you watch them change from who they were to where they are. And as we grow and we get older and you spend a long period of time in prison, you're either going to get it and say, you know what? And these are the people that usually succeed. There's some people out there that they become what we call, and I'm sure you've heard this term before, institutionalized.
Right.
So where they're so used to already having three hots in a cot and not working and having to fight every day to stay alive, they don't know anything else. And when they come out and they have to get a job and they have to support themselves, they don't know how to do it. So the first thing they do is go back to what they know, and that was, you know, robbing. And some people go and commit a crime so they can go back to prison because they can't do it on their own. And that's where the failure part is. And that's where I saw the gap that needed to be bridged. Is when they come out, they're going to have health insurance if they're on medication. They're going to have a place to sleep. They're going to have clothing to put on their back. They're going to have toothpaste and the simple things, amenities in life, to take care of themselves with their hygiene. They're going to have an opportunity to say, hey, what do I want to do? What was my dreams as a child? What did I want to be growing up? Because every child has a dream of being someone when they grow up, whether it's a police officer, a fireman, an airline pilot, a doctor, a therapist, a teacher, a business owner, an entrepreneur. Every child has a dream. And unfortunately, somewhere between their childhood and their adulthood, that dream was interrupted and a nightmare was inserted. And they lost track of that dream. If we can say, hey, and that's part of my workbook. The first thing I talk about in the workbook is, what was your dream? What did you want to do when you grew up? And we reconnect them with that. So they have that same type of enthusiasm and excitement as they did when they were a child. And we bring that to reality and say, okay, well, this is how we're going to make that happen. You get to start over again. And let's go chase that dream that you had when you were a child. And it's successful. And they forget about what they went through. And they forget about the past. And they let go of the past. I talk a lot of things in the book about letting go of the past and moving forward. And you can't drive forward if you're constantly looking in the rearview mirror. So I have you really have to, that's part of the first 90 days is, and they say this in AA and NA is let go and let God. But you have to do that and take that leap of faith and say, okay, what I did to put me in prison is behind me. I'm no longer going to talk about it. I'm not going to let it hold me down. It's not going to be a weight or, you know, an anchor around my waist. I'm going to start over like you have a clean slate now. And we let them leave that all behind. And I do it in a couple of ways. I had an old Rastafarian show me something down in Jamaica one time where sometimes I take some of these guys down to a lake or to a beach and I put them on the beach or the lake next to the water. And I have them draw a circle around themselves and put all their past and all the bad things in that circle. And then I have them step outside the circle. And as the water washes that circle away, it also washes away their past and everything else. It's symbolic, but I learned it from an old Rasta. And I still remember it, and I use it today. It's kind of like Bob Marley, you know, with inside my... You know, I'm just telling everything's going to be all right, you know. So, but these are some things that I use in my workbook to help people let go and leave their past exactly where it belongs in their past. But I would love to go and talk to the, you know, talk to that senator with you.
No, we're going to the legislation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's just going to make it happen for us to get in front of them. But okay. Another thing my friend told me as well, he said, Linda, whatever age a guy goes into prison, I don't care how long they stay there. That's the age he's going to be when he come out. And I'm like, man, yep. No way.
Yep.
I couldn't That's visualize correct. That, you know. But I'm learning that. I see it as people are coming back out of prison that he really has a point there.
Yep. And that's true, because when you're incarcerated, it's kind of like, my mom told me this. She's like, it's like you died, but you're in purgatory somewhere. You're not really dead. And when I came out, it was like you came back to life. You were here. I could give you a hug. I could kiss you again. And in prison, you're literally removed. And it's like for the family, someone dying. And while you're in there, you feel like you're in purgatory.
Wow.
And you feel like Jesus. I just, what have I done? Why am I here? You feel like dying, but you have to be, if you're mentally strong enough to get through it, and that's what sometimes breaks people, that they take that same attitude out into the free world. And the rules that are in prison are not the rules in society. And that's one of the things I teach the guys. I'm like, somebody comes up here, you know, and interrupts the middle of your conversation with the beginning of theirs. In prison, you probably punch the guy in the face. In the real world, you can't do that. So that's part of the transition. People are going to disrespect you out here. And in prison, that wouldn't be allowed. But out here, you have to kind of like turn the other cheek and say, okay, brother, I get it, because you don't want to go back to prison. So the rules change, and that's part of people being institutionalized, because I know a lot of things that happen in prison, you would get shanked over that if someone in the free world did to you. I'm like, God, you know, and I think about it, you wouldn't last very long in prison with that attitude. You know,
I wouldn't last in prison a day, I don't think.
But that's one of the part of the transition, when I sit down and, you know, have the class with the guys and say, hey, this is going to happen. This is how we're going to deal with it. Because these are the results. You know, if you deal with it the way you deal with a situation like this in prison, the results are going to be different. It's not that you're going to gain respect. You're going to gain a new pair of handcuffs and be put in the back of a cop car. So that's something that therapists and, you know, people that think they know how to help people transition, they don't get, because they never lived it. You know, so I mean, I've got scars on my arm, defensive wounds for people pulled out a shank on me. And what they said is, hey, man, he cut you all the way to the white meat. And I'm like, wow. Yeah, I guess he did. But they wanted me to snitch. I didn't snitch. I gained respect.
Right.
Is what I have it's a battle wound, but it's a respect wound at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different rules inside versus outside. And that's the biggest way to, you know, transition. And what I would like to do is find an old rundown hotel, fix it all up, get funding to make it look nice, because you can't just throw them out to the wolves, because they'll fail. They have to be around people where we have, you know, have meetings. We talk about how their day went. They have a place to come back to. They go out into the, what I call it, you know, the wild, which is the world that they're living in outside of prison. They work. They have situations that happen, you know, that pop up, arguments, maybe, maybe not, things they're not used to dealing with, like on a normal level. And then when they come back at night after work, we sit down and talk about how everybody's day went. Everybody, you know, gets together and cooks. We have little, you know, meetings, one-on-ones if they need it, and say, hey, how would you improve, you know, if that situation happened again? And that's what's not happening in the prison system right now.
Right.
You would think in minimum custody, some of these guys get to leave to go off, but they're still, they're going off and working at a state facility, packing boxes or they're loading trucks with forklifts. And I was, you know, I was at Nash County in North Carolina. That's where I served the majority of my time. Then they transferred me to Wake, which I think is shut down now. Wake Correctional,
right,
which is
great. It is.
And I worked on a forklift. But I really didn't have access to people outside of that. So I really didn't deal with what real world scenarios were, nor did they. But when they're introduced to it, it happens so fast, they instinctively, because someone locked up for so long has been institutionalized, they instinctively lash out, like would a wild dog if you cage them up all the time, you know, and then you go in there and rattle their cage. They're going to instinctively lash out. But the therapists and the psychiatrists and the psychologists, they don't understand that.
Exactly.
Why they never lived it. They go home at 5 o'clock.
Right.
They don't see what happens after they go home. And the things that I've seen happen in prison, nightmares were made out of.
First, yeah, me too. I was just in the visitation room. I was
exactly.
Like, oh my God.
But you know, the first year, 16 months, I woke up in cold sweat screaming.
I can't.
With some of the stuff I, you know, and that's hard, and that creates PTSD, and I probably have a little PTSD from it because it's very traumatizing to me. The whole, you know, going from working for, you know, a pilot for the airlines to in a prison cell. So it was a hard transition. And that's another thing that people really don't, when you're coming out, the therapists aren't looking at, is the PTSD associated with it, the loss that they have, you know. Well, right. A family member died. I had my father pass away, and that was not, and I offered, I was like, I'll give you guys $20,000, you know, to pay for two guards and let me go say goodbye to my dad. They wouldn't let me go.
They didn't go for it, would they?
No, no. I just said, I just want to say goodbye to my dad. And right. Like, nope, sorry, judges aren't going to let you do that. And then my grandmother passed away, you know, and they wouldn't let me go see her. And then my brother-in-law passed away, and I couldn't go see her, you know, so, or see him. So I didn't, you know, it's like they took all that away, and I'll never get it back. But I didn't create animosity over it. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I want my pound of flesh. I was like, you know what? Mm-hmm. This is what happened. I can't change that. I cannot go back in time. So I'm not going to sit here and let this torment me and hold me back. I'm just going to have to let it go and move forward. So, and that's what I did.
Now, were you in aviation before you became incarcerated, or how?
Yes,
how
I was. Yep. Well, I just started my career working with the airline, and that's what the other book about Falling from the Sky, it explains how the whole situation happened. And I wasn't with them very long, and, you know, I was accused, and then I had to leave the airlines, and that was a nightmare. And then my wife divorced me, and then she took the kids, and wow. And it just snowballed. It was like year 2000, 9/11 happened, and it was just a complete nightmare. And I lost everything. So I had to, of course, rebuild all that again. And that was the struggle. It's when, you know, you lose everything that you have and then have to go back and rebuild it all over again. That's harder than the first time, you know, getting to that point. But I was able to do it, and I built it back even better than I was with the airlines. So that was like climbing two mountains, trying to get all that back and all the respect back, because people don't care if you're innocent or guilty.
Right.
They hey, well, you were accused of this, so it must be true.
Exactly.
And I try to be, you know, enlighten people. That's one of the reasons I'm looking at three treatments right here for one of my books that had some before COVID. One, if they wanted to do a movie about it or an autobiography on me. And so I'm working with some writers, with some film producers on Falling from the Sky, because they like, this is something that, you know, we need to get out there and have people understand, you know, what's really going on in these prison systems.
Right.
So, it's, you know, I'm going over this, looking at these treatments. So it's, and this would make a great sounding board, because once you get something on film, then, you know, you can reach, then you can reach hundreds of thousands of people.
Exactly.
You know, books are hard to get out and get, but the more I do this, more opportunities, more people I meet, I just have to keep on doing it.
Exactly.
And eventually, you know, there could be a, you know, an A&E autobiography on me on this. And because all this is a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
You can pull, and I tell people when they read the book, it's like, you can pull all the transcripts you want. I can, you know, you'll see. Everything I'm telling you about this judge, it's hard to believe, but you're like, no, not in this, you know, not in this country, not this judicial. Oh, yeah. North Carolina was one of the most corrupt judicials.
Yes.
In that, and probably still is.
It is.
So, but I want to expose it as much as I can. Of course, all of my appellate attorneys passed away. The judge on the trial, she passed away. A lot of people that were there, you know, through it, I'm, you know, the only person it seems like left. My attorneys, you know, this happened back in 2000 with the trial in 2004. This was 25 years old. You know, this is how long ago this, I went through this.
Well, who was your attorney?
George Hughes.
Okay.
And then Bruce Cunningham was my appellate attorney.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
He, unfortunately, he passed away. He went on vacation and passed away in,
exactly.
In England or Ireland.
Yeah.
So, I can't go back and shake their hands and say thank you, but, you know, it is what it is. It's all factual. People go back and, like, you know, we had to Google that because we can't believe this judge was like that. And they saw everything, like, man, you know, to read it, we couldn't believe it. But when we researched it, everything you said was true.
I know.
And that brings a lot of clarity to people when they look at that stuff. Because as much time has passed, people have forgotten about it. But I don't want them to forget about it, because
right.
That's what happens. You forget about the injustice that happens over a period of time. That's what keeps it alive.
Exactly.
If you completely remember the history of the injustice, and you're like, look, we're not going to forget about this. We're not going to stop talking about this, because once you start doing that, people forget about it. And then the fox weasels its way back in the hen house again, and the injustice starts all over again. So it's something we constantly have to be talking about, bringing to the awareness to people, and holding the people accountable that don't want to give a fair trial, and holding the people accountable that just want to, you know, use you as a platform to get, you know, so they can run for their next, you know, whatever they want to run from a judge to an AG to a, you know, governor of the state.
Exactly.
And that's what I was, just a number.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's all. Yeah. And that's what the judicial system looks at. You're just a number. You get caught up in that web or that net. You got to fight like hell to get out.
Yeah.
Because to you, you're just another number.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in any institution, you know, when they say, okay, we need X amount of dollars this year because we have X amount of inmates. If they fall below that threshold of having X many people incarcerated for that year, they lose a certain amount of funding.
Right.
So if they want to keep their $100 million, they have to show that they have X amount of people going through the system. If they don't, then that $100 million might drop to 75.
Right.
So it behooves them to lock people up, whether they're innocent or guilty.
Exactly.
Where they should have gotten 2 years and they gave them 20. Because the longer you stay inside that prison cell, the more money they're going to get state and federally.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's all they care about. That's all they care about. But I'm hoping while I'm still on this planet, I can change that.
You by and working me both. And that's why I think God put us together.
Yeah, probably so.
Because, I have a lot of connections in North Carolina. I'm a North Carolina native. So you're not a North Carolina native, right?
Yep. I was born and raised in Raleigh.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yep.
I was saying, I've got to ask him. So how did you get to Florida?
Well, I moved down there. I went to Ravenscroft, St. Timothy's Hill High School. And then I went to public school with my where I lived with my dad. So I was raised by a single mother. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to Chowan or Murfreesboro, North Carolina. I played football for Chowan College out in Murfreesboro. And I came down here one spring break to Tampa, and I loved it so much, I decided to move to Florida.
I know that's right.
Yeah. Then after I, you know, my first wife, I was like, well, I want to take, you know, we got pregnant, and I was like, well, I want to raise my kids where I was raised. So I thought, you know, it was a good place to be. And that's when the proverbial wheels came off the bus, and everything went downhill from there. And that's where I lost everything. And it goes, being accused for second degree rape is nothing to sneeze at. And that's why I had to, you know, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book originally, was because people kept on asking me, you know, my story. And I was like, I'm tired of telling my story. I'm going to write a book so you guys can read the story and read what I went through and read, you know, vindictiveness, in my mind shouldn't incarcerate someone because things, you don't get what you want. And it was unfortunate, set of circumstances that happened. They say there's no worse evil than a woman scorned.
I agree with that.
You know, I was like, oh my God, how could you accuse me of something like this? And the state picked it up and ran with it. And I couldn't believe what was happening. I was like, how in the world? I didn't have due process. That, you know, she never showed up. The case was in the charges were dropped, and then they reindicted me. If you look at the craziness behind what happened, and then you look at how she just kind of just trampled all over my rights, and she was prosecuting me from the bench, and she was known to do this. Evelyn Hill, she was, you know, she was, we called her Evelyn Hill. Hey, we started my, because that's what she was, pure evil. She was using the N-word in the courtrooms talking to defendants.
Wow.
And I was like, how in the world could this woman get away with this? I put it, we started, my advocates started a website, and it went to every single law firm in the state of North Carolina. And gained so much attention that the AMP, the Associated Press, were calling, and Washington, D.C. was wondering what was going on. Jesse Helms, which is a senator, saying, what's going on in Raleigh with this circuit court judge?
Right.
It created a huge mess. And I think Beverly Lake was the Supreme Court justice at the time.
Okay.
And he said, you got two choices. We're just going to throw you off the bench, or you're going to submit your letter of resignation to the governor. And I think it was Beasley at the time. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
He had submit her letter of resignation to the governor. And she was cited that she would never be able to, of course, practice law or run for another elected position in the state of North Carolina ever. Mm-hmm. And that's what she had to do. Because not just me, I was the bad apple she bought, that she took a bite out of.
Mm.
But it was, you know, me standing up for all the other people that went in front of her. And we got so many emails of family saying, thank you so much. We didn't have money to fight this.
Mm-hmm.
Now my son or my husband is getting a second chance, and you know, they're going to retry the case. And it just created a watershed. And I was blessed to be able to help. There's just so many different ways that the situation helped so many different people. It gave prison guards a different respect that the prison at Nash County. It gave the therapist there a different look on things. On, you know, it helped people that went before the judge. The AG was really like examining what was going on when, you know, the person, the Raleigh PD detective never questioned any of my witnesses. I had like six of them. Mm-hmm. The night that she allegedly, supposedly raped her, that were there saying, no, that didn't happen. We were all here. She threw all their testimonies out of the courtroom. And the agent's like, why? I had to hire my own private investigator to do the state's job. And the more you read the book Falling from the Sky, the more you'll see, and you can't, I can't believe this happened. You don't want to believe it, but if you research it, you'll see it's, you can't make this stuff up. So, but it changed a lot, and I'm glad that my case is probably still helping people to this day, because I know it set a precedent for the state of North. I was the only, this is what I was told from Bruce Cunningham. You're the only person that I know of, and then my colleagues know of, that has had a judge removed from the bench.
Yeah, I think he's
because
right.
of your case. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be that person, but I guess I am. So, but it helped a lot of people. And at the time, I'm glad I was that person now because, I look back, at it mm-hmm. and it needed to happen. But at the time, you don't want to be that person.
Right.
But I was. I'm sure Jesus didn't want to be the person that had to carry the cross, but he
exactly.
did.
Exactly. Right, because my grandkids sent me this saying the other day. This guy said, "Why would people want to have faith in Jesus when he got holes in his hands or something?" And I'm like, really? Come on now. I don't know about your mindset. But listen, it's been a pleasure. I do want to take this opportunity to thank you for doing this broadcast for me. And also, could you drop three nuggets on my listeners to let them know how they can live their best life?
Well, let bygones be bygones. Never hold a grudge. And forgiveness. Forgiveness is the strongest thing someone can do in their life. And it's hard. It's probably the hardest. But I had to forgive a lot of people to put me through what I went through. But yeah,
well, that's where would be you are today.
Yeah.
Yeah, that got you to where you are today.
Yeah, I don't hold a grudge when people do any wrong. I forgive them when they, act amok or try to do something to make me look bad or hurt me in any personal way. Mm-hmm. And then I help people in my community. Okay. What you put in, you will get out of it.
Right.
That's why I continue to do what I do.
Well, I definitely thank God for bringing you across my life. I can tell you that. And I know you mentioned a website at the beginning, but how else can my listeners get in contact with you? This is going out to over 3 million people.
Oh, wow. Okay, so my website is, of course, CaptainWillSmith.com, and my email is CaptainSmitty@gmail.com. Okay. That's S-M-I-T-T-Y, and that was my dad's nickname in the Coast Guard, was Smitty.
Oh, was it? Okay. Well, like I said, we got a lot of work to do. Like the Bible say, we got few laborers out here. So look like you and me and you have the ability to do the same thing, shut these prisons down and get these people to live in the life God placed them on this earth to live.
We just need to help them, and we need to educate the people that are incarcerating. Some people belong where they are. Some people don't. And we need to, there's a fine line with that.
Yes, it is.
And we really need to help the people that have a mental health issue. That is so important. So important. And I don't know why we got away from that. We were doing it at one point. We need to get back to that. We really, really do need to get back to the mental health part.
Yeah, I totally agree with you as well. Recently, I've been looking at this guy, Lee Hamrick, on YouTube. He's a self-diagnosis narcissist. And just to listen at this guy, and you think about your life, you're like, I was involved with somebody like that, okay?
Yep, yep.
But knowledge is power, and a lot of people just don't want to know. They don't want to accept the truth. And it just blows my mind.
It is, but you have to open their eyes. They have to see the light. They have to, you got to experience darkness, experience light, but they need to be brought, awareness needs to be brought to the floor. And this is fixable. This is curable. We just have to pull everyone's head out of the sand and they have to talk about this and make them aware of it and say, hey, this is not going anywhere until we start talking about it and start addressing it, because it's only going to get worse.
You definitely got that right. But, you know, if they don't address it, the prison system will definitely stay in business for a very, very long time. I can tell you that.
Yeah. And that's not, you know, that's not what we need, because our taxpayer dollar can go so much further with helping people than incarcerating people.
That and by so incarcerating true.
Something, you create more harm than you do help. So we need to stop their stinking thinking.
Exactly. Exactly, because that's exactly right. What it is.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, half of them need to be incarcerated that's running the prison system, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, see, the only difference between the prison guard and the prisoner is the prison guard didn't get caught.
Exactly.
That's the only difference.
Yeah, I used to work at the chaplain's department at the in North Carolina, and I'm like, look, y'all need to be the ones locked up. Y'all need to set some of them people free, and y'all need to be locked up. They were like, Miss Monroe. I'm like, I'm telling you the truth, what I'm seeing. I guess God sent me here to shake y'all up. Y'all better get it right.
Yep. And I've seen it. I've seen the stuff that's going on. And they feel safe because they know that if anybody complains, like, oh, no, don't ever believe anything that the inmates say. It's all lies. They're just trying to manipulate.
Exactly. That is all you hear. But, you know, I thank God for discernment and... You know, I could see things that they don't know I can see. So
yep.
I'm like, God put me here for a reason. So whatever you say, if you're not saved, filled with the Holy Ghost, I'm not listening to nothing that you say, okay?
But we can help. I look forward to going, taking on this and changing some lives.
Yeah, because that's the key. We got to... reach back and pull these people out of the darkness, for sure.
Yeah, because they're in the darkness right now. They just need to shed some light on it.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, so broadcasting from Vashani Radio, iHeart Life from New York City, this is the Linda Monroe Show, and I am Linda Monroe. If you want to know more about me and what I do, go to lindamonroe.com. Again, don't forget to go to Google Play and download Vashani Radio app. We're live from New York City talking about in and everything. I also want to take the opportunity to thank my listeners for listening to my broadcast each and every week. Captain Smith dropped them nuggets, so I hope y'all take them and run with them. This show is sponsored by Rashad's Reliable Cars, Terry Ingram Sr., CEO and owner. Too blessed to be stressed. Also, don't forget to go to lindamonroe.com, order my book, Overcoming All Odds, The Life I Should Not Have Lived, 5 Ways to Heal from a Toxic and Abusive Relationship, and 100 Years of Blessing. That's an autobiography of my mom's life. She stayed here on this earth for 100 years. Also go to www.vonoimag.com. Got an article on there about abusive and toxic relationships as well. So until next week, be blessed, and the best is yet to come. Again, Captain Will, thank you a lot. We'll be talking soon, okay?
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Get exclusive content you just can't wait to hear. Hit us with your feedback. We want to know how you feel. So download Vashani Radio. Get it free from the App Store. Download Vashani Radio. See our features and much more. Download the Vashani Radio app for free now.